cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Romani's always present. Are you well, Jonathan?
Yeah, as can be.
I mean, we've had international guests all along. We should have maybe sent through our things to get the foreign, I don't know, documentary award at the Oscars or something. Give a bit of African nominations there.
Yeah, we could do that, but then we'd have to like criticize like the American government and ignore that our government was also useless.
Oh, right.
You know, because the Iranians won, and then they were like, you Americans are terrible. And it's like, yeah, all right,
yeah,
about
Iran.
That.
Yeah, about the thousands of journalists in prison in Iran. But nevertheless. Yeah. So Obama apparently wiretapped Donald Trump. Okay, wiretapping is like 1980s. Or
yeah, 1960s. But Donald Trump's 70, and it's like, the guy probably watches Magnum PI on like reruns.
Right,
so.
And I actually believe Trump that he was so-called wiretapped, but only because practically every single person in the US is fucking wiretapped, right? That's what Edward Snowden Leaks was about.
Yeah, the NSA was listening to everyone and watching everything you do.
Yeah, so I don't know why it's a surprise to everyone. Okay, for Donald Trump to make it about himself. I think he only cares
I think Nixon did have to resign over doing shit like that.
Oh, yeah, but that was another era, man.
Yeah, it was another era. And actually today we are talking with a guest who is going to reflect back on a few other eras that we've come from as a species, I suppose, as humankind. We've really advanced quite a lot. You know, we're often told how terrible everything is.
Yes, especially ourselves.
Yeah.
We are quite terrible. And Sweden's quite terrible too. So thankfully we found our guest just at the within the 2 hours that internet's available in Sweden.
Yeah.
You know, due to the
And he's in he's near Malmo.
Yeah,
so,
due to the state of emergency and the grenades. And Denmark is invading. I don't know what's going on there. I was actually ask Trump.
It's very explosive, very explosive. So our guest today is Johan Norberg. Johan is a Swedish author. He's a historian and he's a fellow at the Cato Institute. And he's written a very interesting book about human progress. Johan, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Hello there.
Hi. Thank you so much for coming on the show. As you know, we picked you up on a American podcast, which we listened to, the Cato Institute's libertarianism.org podcast. And you wrote a book about the future and progress and human progress and why we should stop being so pessimistic about our lives on Earth. Do you want to expand a bit about how you got to the point of writing the book?
Well, yes, the background is that I'm absolutely terrified every morning when I wake up and follow the news around the world, because it's only about explosions, poverty, famine, and disaster generally. But when I study the statistics and the data, and when I read history as well, I notice something completely different. The fact that there has never been a better time to be alive than today, if you look at average living standards, the fact that we live longer lives in better health, with more wealth and with more opportunities and freedoms than ever before. So there's a tremendous progress in the world. It has been around basically since the Industrial Revolution, but during the era of globalization, it's really picked up pace. And at the same time, almost no one notices what is going on and why it's happening. So that's why I wanted to write this book, to explain this.
So, Johan, am I on? There we go. So let's just discuss the causes of such progress. So the statistics do bear out the fact that we live longer, we eat more, we work less, we are much healthier. So let's take all that as a given. What reasons do you give for that amount of progress in a relatively short period of time, I might
say? Yeah. You write about specific individuals, inventors, entrepreneurs, inventions, things that happened in various areas. Everything from sanitation to higher productivity to artificial fertilizer in this book. But when I then summarize what has been going on, I summarize it in three aspects. It's the freedom to explore strange new information and knowledge and accumulate knowledge across the generations, freedom of research and finding out basically how to do things in a better way, but also the freedom to experiment with those ideas, with those technologies, and to experiment with new business models that make use of these things. Everything from how to increase productivity in agriculture to the logistics, the infrastructure, like container shipping, for example, that makes modern international trade possible. So it's exploration and it's experiments, but it's also exchange, the freedom to exchange these ideas, these technologies, these goods and services across borders. I think those three aspects are the most important ones. And the one thing that they all have in common is that it takes a certain degree of human freedom to do strange new things that the majority would not have thought of, or the government would not have thought of. The freedom for individuals to experiment with these ideas and technologies and business models, that's what starts this progress in various areas.
I mean, I do tend to agree with you on that. But the past decade or so, there's been two major books about why nations in general succeed or fail. So there was the first one, Gun, Germs, and Steel, where Jared Diamond gives a very geographically centric hypothesis. You know, people closer to the river, who had fertile ground, they succeeded, whereas others did not. And Why Nations Fail made the claim that institutions matter, especially inclusive institutions in a certain republic of sorts. I often think it could be a factor of both, of course. But do you have a third, may I say, a third factor coming in, where it is about experimentation based on a legal framework, so to speak, of a nation? Because no one would ever create Red Bull in the Soviet Union, for example.
Right.
Because no one could actually experiment there.
That's right. I would say that I think that both these explanations bear some important truths to the matter, but I don't think they're really sufficient. I think that Jared Diamond explains why certain areas were ahead of others 1,000 years ago, basically. But it could have happened in, it's not just Europe or the Eurocentric civilization, but it was also the Arab Middle Eastern civilization and the Chinese one. So why didn't they develop? Something else must have happened there. Then I also think that there's some things to the institutions, the legal structure, and the kind of basically the fact that to work long term, to invest in a project that happens long term, gives reward in the long term, you need some sort of stability, some rule of law, so that you know what will happen in the future. And I think that Europe was definitely ahead when it comes to that. But when you look at these great breakthroughs, for example, by the Industrial Revolution began to really pick up pace in England, my theory would be that there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in, as the famous philosopher Leonard Cohen puts it. The fact that these institutions, authorities, they do not have total control of everything. The reason why it began to happen in England was that the old monopolies and the guilds, they didn't have power in certain cities, in certain areas. And that's where the inventions began to happen. And I think we can see that again and again. Suddenly things happen because there's a crack in the system, and that allows individuals to experiment. For example, Norman Borlaug, who probably saved the lives of a billion people by making sure we had modern agriculture, better crops, but also use of more artificial fertilizer and other things. He succeeded because there was a certain window of opportunity. And this happened specifically in India and Pakistan because they were suffering. They had a tremendous famine, and there was a war. So they had to rapidly feed their population. And suddenly, all those unthinkable ideas that he would never been allowed to experiment with, he could suddenly do that in the midst of that disaster. And that changed the world dramatically. And I don't think any analysis of geography or institutions can really claim for that. It's the cracks. That's where many interesting things happen.
I think that's the story of the, I think it's a sewage system in London, next to the Houses of Parliament. I can't remember which year. I think it was the 17th century. It stank so much that the MPs almost refused to sit in a session of the House, so to speak. So they actually found a way to clean up the River Thames. But I think it was something to do with a disease. I think cholera was fought against.
That's right. Midst 1800s, basically, two big outbreaks of cholera, and they had to evacuate Houses of Parliament. And then that's when they really understood that something had to be done. And then, you know, they even had to. They compared the River Thames to hell in Greek mythology. Benjamin Disraeli did. The stench was so bad that the curtains of the Houses of Parliament was soaked in lime chloride before it was abandoned. Jeez. And that was the moment when they began to sort of finding out that, look, it's a bad thing to have human waste and refuse in the same place where we get the drinking water. Now it sounds like something obvious that they should have realized. Yeah, pretty obvious. But, you know, a genius is someone who says something obvious for the first time.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because around the same time with those cholera outbreaks was some of the advancements in sort of disease theory and germ theory around in medicine comes from a lot of that, and the epidemiology of disease was studied with regards to the cholera outbreaks, because they realized that it was in certain areas that it was happening, and they could sort of track the disease in a way. So it is quite interesting in terms of. What you're saying is that in terms of invention, necessity is the mother of invention, excuse me. So are we as inventive, are we as creative? Do we come up with these solutions as much in current day as we did back then? Or are we not as forced to find these sort of radical solutions which make massive changes to humanity?
That is a very interesting question, and it's very intriguing, and because many intelligent people have come to opposite conclusions here. Some say that we have a stagnation when it comes to new knowledge and breakthroughs. Others say that we live through the most dynamic era in a way, and I think they could both be right, because when I talk to researchers, when I talk to inventors, and when I talk to some in businesses and their development organizations, I'm shocked by the fascinating things that they come up with. Everything from biotechnology to artificial intelligence, I think they all have the potential to really change the world. But one thing that has changed is the rules and the regulations, because it's not as easy to put things to work as it used to be, in a way, partly because we don't live in the era of necessity as much anymore, so that we've built up systems of regulating things, of making sure that we really experiment with things in a laboratory setting for decades before we really put things to use. We even have the precautionary principle in many legal documents in the Western world, which is basically a principle that says don't do anything for the first time. It's only when we've done it again and again that you can do it for the first time. So I think that we have tremendous breakthroughs. We're on the cusp of tremendous breakthroughs, but we also have to allow it to really happen in the real world. And we might be a bit more cautious today than we used to be. And that's partly what happens as you get richer. Mm. You begin to invest more in safety, and because we think that we have more to lose now than we have to gain from new breakthroughs.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, it's interesting. I think you do use the example with regards to vaccine development. So when we're pushed, we can actually achieve sort of great things. You know, we've got many examples in history of sort of viral infections killing off large percentages of the population. Then in the early part of this century, we have swine flu coming out, and very quickly it's dealt with, even though the WHO originally predicted that it could once again kill millions, if not hundreds of millions. So when we need to, we tend to be pushed there. How much more, though, do you think, I know you're a big proponent of freedom and liberty, and how much do you think that in some ways deregulation and freedom are going to drive the future of this? Because I'm thinking of something like space travel. You know, we went there in the 60s because the Americans and the Russians were competing with each other in a Cold War, and then we lost interest in a way, and now the private market has taken over.
Yes, and I think that's a great example which could work as a metaphor for many other areas of invention and of development. That, yes, big government plans can achieve certain things. If you devote all your resources to one goal, you might actually accomplish something more in a shorter period than an open free market would have done, for example, putting a man on the moon. But the problem is that this doesn't create the... it's two things that it doesn't create. It doesn't create a multiple alternatives, competing and cooperating institutions and businesses and inventors who can try to put things to use. It's only one big attempt, and if that fails, it's really no use. But the other thing is that it doesn't create an infrastructure around it. That's the major achievement. If you look at any of all these inventions that I talk about, it takes something more than one effort. It all depends on economic and technological infrastructure surrounding it. If you look at, for example, the breakthroughs in natural gas extraction, particularly in the United States,
with fracking.
But yes, fracking is an idea that has been around for a couple of decades, but it didn't really happen. No one big really was interested in either governments or big businesses. It happened after a while through basically one major entrepreneur who was really devoted to it. But it also, it had to wait for a certain infrastructure to be there. Mm-hmm. It was dependent on, of course, things like the financial infrastructure in the United States that made it possible to invest in things that seemed that like there was a little chance that this could work in the long run. But it also dependent on a particular types of chemicals, the particular combination of fluids that could be used to really open up these rocks. And that took other businesses who invented and experimented with these things. It also depended on horizontal drilling, which was a new technology that came from other places. So it's almost all, it takes a village, basically, of businesses, of researchers, and of others who continuously work very hard to improve their particular small area of expertise to get breakthroughs done in other areas as well. And I think space exploration has really is the perfect metaphor. It's not enough to put a man on the moon. It looks great, you have good footage, but then you just go back home, and that's the end of space exploration. It took hundreds of different eccentrics and entrepreneurs and businesses who began doing this and dependent on an infrastructure of other businesses with their expertise to get it going.
Joe, and I want to talk a bit more about the role of the state in all of this. So, I mean, you in, from Sweden, and 120 years ago, Sweden was in a very dire place. Even a few centuries ago, there was widespread famine and all sorts of other ills. So now, for example, Sweden is often seen as socialist, which is untrue, of course. It has a thriving capitalist class and a very generous welfare system. So But as a state, do you think a state can be the driving force of innovation, or a lack of state is better? Obviously, we're not going to compare the US and the Soviet Union. That's quite obvious. Yeah. But a general middle-of-the-road liberal democracy, in terms of where it actually does protect property rights, it does enforce contracts, it does enforce the rule of law. Obviously, those are better places to be for innovation than other areas or other states.
Right. I think Sweden is an informative example of this, because 150 years ago, we were poorer than the average sub-Saharan African countries today, with higher poverty rates, with shorter life expectancy and so on. And then something dramatic happened in the late 19th century, which turned Sweden into one of the richest countries on the planet in just 100 years later, in 1950, basically. And that was before we had the growth of the state in Sweden, when we had the fastest progress, when we began to see the greatest inventions in Swedish businesses, where they used new technologies to create what we still call the genius industries in Sweden. That was an era before the First World War, when the Swedish government still only consumed less than 6% of GDP in Sweden. So, and as late as the 1950s, when Sweden was already one of the richest countries on the planet, we still had lower taxes than the average European country had, and lower taxes than the United States. It was only then that politicians began to see that, look, now we've created all of this wealth, now we can begin to redistribute those resources, now we can begin to consume rather than just invent and invest and produce things. So I think that's an interesting example of how private initiative really got these things going, and also basically was behind the most interesting investments in research and development. And that's still the private industry is still incredibly important in those areas in Sweden. One of the reasons why we are ahead of many other countries when it comes to research and development as a percentage of GDP is that we have bigger multinational companies. Companies that are then exposed constantly to international competition, and they also have bigger research and development areas in their companies. So, what does this say about the world? Well, I think it says that the initiative often come from the private sectors, and then when it builds all the these resources is often used by the government, but rarely does the government know better where to invest, where to which technologies to pick as winners in the future, as compared to what private businesses would do.
Yeah, well, you know, it is a bit of a model. I want to talk a little bit. You've mentioned sub-Saharan Africa and a comparison there to Sweden. We'll get there because we're in sub-Saharan Africa, and obviously we've still got, as our politicians would refer to it, many challenges to overcome. But every morning, you alluded to it when we started, every morning you can wake up and turn on the television, or you look at your phone on Twitter or whatever sort of sources that you use, and you will be told the thing that's going to kill you. Or the thing that did kill people overnight, you know, whether it be a natural disaster. You know, in the 90s, scientists were, of course, going to fiddle with DNA, and that's why we end up with movies like Jurassic Park, because ultimately the dinosaurs are going to come eat us. After that, we had a whole bunch of natural disaster films, be it Twister or all these sort of movies, The Perfect Storm. So the environment was then going to kill us. And of late, it seems as if the latest thing to be terrified of, as if you're a human, is that the robots are coming to kill us as well. Humans seem to have this nature where they look for the negative, they look for the thing that is likely, they believe, to present the next greatest threat. Do you want to give us some data in terms of the things that really used to kill us in large numbers that just don't anymore, and we've managed to overcome?
Yes, I think that the one data point that summarizes many of the developments here is life expectancy. And it has, despite all the terrible things that happened in the 20th century, life expectancy increased from 30 years to, well, 72 years today.
Yeah, that's global.
Which is, that's global life expectancy, right? And I mean, 200 years ago, there was not a single country in the world where life expectancy was longer than 40 years. Now there's not a single country where life expectancy is shorter than 40 years. So it kind of shows you that something amazing happened in the last, just last four or five generations of people around the world. Now, what happened? Well, partly it's to do with broad factors like better nutrition, higher agricultural productivity and trade made it possible for us to feed our kids. In the first 100 years ago, basically every decade, some 10 to 15 million people died because of chronic undernourishment, because of large-scale famines. And now with a much, much larger population around the world, we don't get up to more than 500,000 per decade. So it's a tremendous development. Many other things are related to reduction in poverty on the whole, which makes it possible to do things like invest in safer water, invest in better living conditions, electricity, gas stoves, so that you don't die from indoor air pollution because you burn solid fuel to prepare your food. But also, obviously, all the changes in better medical technology, in vaccines, in sanitation, that which meant that all those things, tuberculosis, cholera, the plague, smallpox, measles, all those things that everybody was certain that at least some of their kids would suffer and die from, they're not there anymore. And it's something that we rarely think about today because we've got this mindset that you never wake up and think, oh gosh, I'm so happy I didn't get the polio today or the measles or smallpox. But instead we think, what'll happen with the latest bird flu or Ebola? That's just the way the human mind works. And that's probably something that helped our survival traditionally. We're rarely happy about how far we've come, but we think about the next threat to our survival, and then we try to deal with that instead.
Well, I think the big problem we face is we can relay facts all day long, but people just don't seem to want to believe them. Because we actually come from such a high base, especially in the West, that bad news sells, right? If it what's the term? If it bleeds, it leads. So the media is quite culpable in this regard, but people just don't seem to understand that we are at the zenith of human civilization in 2017, but somehow we are regressing apparently because who knows, politics or ISIS or something like that. But these are such minor and minute details on the grand trend of progress. So how do you counter someone who doesn't believe what you say, rather than just relaying data, of course?
Given that you're sitting in Sweden right now, and I'm sure there are criminals literally at your door, according to President Trump.
Yes, exactly. And I'm even in Malmö right now, in southern Sweden, which is supposed to be a place where it's burning everywhere. But that's the way it works, and that's the way, if it bleeds, it leads, not just in the media, but also in our own minds. I remember a story, a couple of foreign friends who asked me about Gothenburg, which is the second biggest Swedish city. And they said, is it safe to go there? And sort of why? Well, we've noticed that there are riots and fires everywhere. It turns out that the only time they've ever heard about the city was when we had a European Union summit in 2001. And George W. Bush, the American president, was there, and there were big riots against him and fires. That's the only time that Gothenburg was ever in the world news. And obviously that's then, it sticks in people's minds. And that's the way we see the whole world. The old survey of, I think it's Baltimore in the US shows that the more people follow the cable news, the more they exaggerate the extent of crime, but not in their own area of the city, because that's the one they know firsthand. And they know that it's fairly safe, and it's probably been much safer in the last few decades. But they all thought that crime was much, much worse in other parts of the city, because that's the areas that they only heard about from the news. And it's difficult to do anything about that, because we always want the most dramatic thing that happened around the world. That's why we pick up our cell phone. That's why we pick up the news. And I think this has been made worse because of global media and social media, because now journalists can pick from the whole world and find something. So even though homicides have been reduced by half in Western Europe and in the US in the last 2 decades, there's always a serial murderer on the loose somewhere. And then that will top the news cycle everywhere, and we will all think that it's more common than it really is. So how do you counter that? Well, you need to point to the data. You need to tell people about their own biases and to understand that, yes, this is happening, and that's part of reality, but we also have to look at the broad picture on everything that does not make the news, because that's more important, and we have to be persistent in doing that. And it doesn't always work, and especially because there are also a lot of politicians who want to exploit our fears, because they know that, you know, it was H.L. Mencken who once put it that the role of the politician is to constantly make people frightful, fearful, with new threats all the time, because then they will be clamoring for safety, and they want the strong man to protect them and put things right. So you just have to be persistent, I think.
Yeah, I tend to agree with everything you say. And generally speaking, I think people are quite poorly educated in history, and especially, can they actually trust their own instinct at any given time? For example, in South Africa, where it is a very violent place, as borne out by the statistics, but people are afraid that they'll be attacked absolutely everywhere they go, specifically tourists, whereas I've been living here for 25 years and have been attacked twice, for example, which is twice too many, of course, but in 25 years, it's not terrible by any means.
Yeah. I think that this is something that people, in a way, intuitively realize when you explain why that bias is there. That's the thing, that it's not enough with data, I don't think. I mean, just an anecdote. I made a graph that summarized some of the things that has happened in the world in the last 25 years. Reduction of absolute poverty, of child mortality, of illiteracy, and of something more that's nasty. And they've all been almost or even more halved in 25 years. And I published this on social media and on Twitter, and someone retweeted me immediately saying, look at this terrible graph. It confirms my sense that we're going to hell in a handcart. She had read the graph upside down. And many people do that. And when I ask her and others who do these things, why do you do that? And they tell me, it's not out of ignorance. It's because I pay close attention to the news. And I only hear about awful things. And then that's why I also have a chapter in my book on perceptions, how we create our own perception of the world and why it is biased, probably for evolutionary reasons. Those hunter-gatherers who were just content with having survived another day, they would probably be eaten by a predator or have a lack of food the next day. It was those who were a bit worried, who continued to hunt and gather a little bit more. They survived, and they passed their genes onto us, but also their stress hormones onto us. So we constantly look for horrible things, because somewhere in our reptilian brains, we think it's a threat to our survival. I think people can understand that they have that bias and that it's always there, that bad is stronger than good, as the psychologists put it. And if you combine that with the data, which tells them another side of the story, then I think many people buy that argument.
Unfortunately, you do get this cabal of, they call themselves progressives, funnily enough, but the Naomi Kleins of the world, the Paul Mason, Michael Moore is one of them too, where they call themselves progressive and they have all the benefits of freedom and capitalism afforded to them. And they use that to decry neoliberalism. That it rapes the country, whatever, it rapes the earth, and it's enforcing slavery, not in a literal sense, but in the Marxist sense, that despite all this progress, capitalism and freedom is still very much the problem. And they managed to sell out, you know, their books sell out and their talk sell out and all these sort of things. But I mean, I assume that's the bias. Are those people that understand their bias and exploit it for their own benefits? Or do people actually seem to believe them?
Yes, this is very strange. I remember Naomi Klein writing in one of her books that capitalism was unleashed in its most barbaric form in 1990, unleashed upon the world. So what happened after it was unleashed? Well, extreme poverty was reduced by 3/4, and it happened the most in the places that she condemned the most for having liberalized the markets the most. So if that's... barbaric capitalists, we need more of it. But I think this is partly, it's the same thing. They can obviously point to problems in the world, things that are not right in the world. As I think leftist economist Joseph Stiglitz put it, if global capitalism is so great, why are so many people poor and miserable? And it's true. A lot of people are poor and miserable. Fewer than ever before. We made greater progress than ever before against it, especially in the places that liberalized the most. But there will always be those problems. And then people will always be eager to look for some culprit. Because what people fail to realize is the basic fact that poverty does not need an explanation. It's the rise out of poverty that has to be explained, because poverty was there first. It was only then, when we began to climb out of it, that we needed an explanation. And according to my point of view, this was because of the rise of industrialization and of free market capitalism. But I think there's also something else that they are dealing with, especially in people who are rich and who buy Michael Moore's and Naomi Klein's books. It's a certain sense of bad conscience as well. They know that they lead fairly comfortable lives. And two things happen then. One is what some psychologists have called it collapse anxiety. If things have been going fairly well, you have this sense, because we're all sort of farmers. We know that after good weather comes bad weather at some point. We cannot just continue like this. There must be something wrong, something that can happen. I think a lot of environmental doom mongering is really based on this. If it gets even better, it must be even worse sooner or later.
Life's a horror movie. You're just waiting for someone to poke out of the shadows.
Exactly, and especially when you're very content and you're sitting on the sofa in the horror movie and girl meets boy, then the monster must appear. But then I also think there's something else. It's this zero-sum game attitude to the economy that has always, the basic misunderstanding of how the economy works, which tend to say that if someone gains, someone else must lose. And I think both the sort of economically illiterate left and the economically illiterate nationalist right buy into the zero-sum game. They all think that the left says that if the Western world has benefited tremendously, it must be on somebody's back. We must be to blame. We've condemned others to starvation. The new nationalist right and the Trumps of the world, they notice that this is not what happened. It's on the contrary. The Chinese and the Indians and the Vietnamese, they grow richer faster than ever before. But they still buy the zero-sum game. So they think that we must be the losers.
Yeah, it's unfair.
Richer places, exactly. So then we must stop them, and we must have protectionism and other things to stop them. They all live in a kind of a pre-Adam Smithian world where they don't understand that on the free market, no deal ever happens unless both both sides think that they benefit.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the whole point of free trade. It's two parties coming together and making an agreement. There's nothing more to it. We've got, about 10 minutes or a little bit less to go. Obviously, we've managed to overcome famine to a large extent. You know, starvation worldwide, I think you mentioned, is less than or around 10% of the world is sort of in some sort of malnourished state, whereas it was up around 50% 100 years ago. We've overcome that. War was obviously a large component of what killed us. Disease as well. A lot of these things are starting to either disappear or have largely been reduced in terms of their threat to us sort of living good and sustainable and healthy lives. What are the sort of biggest problems that are still on our radar that we are battling to some extent to overcome? This would be in areas like where we are in sub-Saharan Africa and elsewhere. I'm sure Africa falls well within the areas where there still are relatively large problems. And what are some of the solutions? Is it just sort of continue and things will get better, or are there specific things that you think need to happen?
Yes, I think that obviously we can look at specific threats that could happen in the future. I think a lot of people are concerned with that, obviously. And it's always the case that bad things will happen. They always have. So the only question is, how are we prepared to deal with that? The level of wealth and technology and knowledge that it takes to deal with that is greater than ever before. So I think that's the solution, to continue to build that. But I think that what's still the biggest problems around the world, and definitely in sub-Saharan Africa, is that still problems of poverty. The fact that too few people have access to electricity, have access to safe water, sanitation, and a lot of people still die. A lot of children still die because they don't have access to the kind of medical technology that exists in other parts of the world. There are no sort of simple silver bullets to these things, because they all take a particular kind of social and economic and physical infrastructure to deal with. But the best way to get that is, I think, this continuous increase in economic wealth and of knowledge and of technology. It might not sound terribly romantic, but I still think it's the best lifesaver.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, in closing, I think it's very important to state that the famine that's happening today is planned famine. It's not a natural fallacy. It's not an appeal to nature. People that are starving today are if you look at Venezuela, if you look at Zimbabwe,
North Korea,
those are all planned famines. It's not a state of being anymore. Someone has to actually try starve people. And I think that's quite unfortunately not for those people who are starving, but in general, that is absolutely brilliant for us, where the state of being is not suffering and hunger, really.
Exactly, and that's an incredibly good point, because it also shows that the biggest problem in dealing with continued development, the biggest thing that stands in the way, is those planners and those crooks who ruin progress for others, because we have knowledge, and it's more easily transmitted across borders than ever before, and likewise with technology and know-how generally. But you can still ruin it. I mean, we have a famine in northern Nigeria because Boko Haram has destroyed farms and ruined livelihoods over there. We still have sort of the planned destruction of individual initiative in countries like Venezuela from the top down. So basically, the biggest obstacle is not natural anymore. It's those people who ruin progress, consciously or unconsciously, just as a sort of an effect of what they did to try to improve the world. So it's people standing in the way of progress. That's the greatest risk.
Well, Johannes, apologies. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it. I understand you need to go somewhere, but we really do appreciate you fitting us in. And as always, it's fascinating to listen to you. I just want to tell the listeners, your book is Progress, 10 Reasons to Look Forward to the Future. It was published last year, is available, obviously, online, Amazon, and all major bookstores, I'm sure. Is there anything final you want to say?
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. So I appreciate that. That's really an interesting conversation, I think.
Where can we find you, social media style?
Well, you can find me on my website, johannorberg.net, but also my official website on Facebook, Johan Norberg Official. And you can also find me on Twitter as just the Johan Norberg.
You can engage with people who read graphs upside down.
Exactly. I've dealt with people who read graphs in all kinds of ways now.
Well, Twitter is the one place you won't get an apology for that.
At least they read something, Johan. Most people don't. Nevertheless, thank you so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate your time, and all the best for the book. Hope it sells extremely well. So don't read newspapers. Read this book, people. It's more honest.
Yeah, data. Thank you so much, Johan.
Thank you very much.
And that was Johan Norberg.
Yeah, it's always interesting when, as he seems to believe, and I read some excerpts of his book, and basically, if you actually leave people with as much freedom as possible to pursue the individual, some would call selfish, goals, everyone else benefits. It's actually quite an amazing.
Tell us more, Ayn Rand.
I haven't read one Ayn Rand book. People keep saying I'm a Randian. I've never read her.
But look, I mean, a lot of the stuff that he goes into in the book, and it's divided into specific chapters. For example, there's a chapter on sanitation, and he goes into the advances that were made in that and the benefits that resulted in that. Talk about war, talk about famine. He mentioned it now in our discussion quickly, but the gentleman who was looking at new ways of agriculture, and he attributes the invention of compost, us being able to sort of manufacture manure. Well, I don't know what the correct sort of scientific term is, but
fertilizer.
But fertilizer. Oh, there we go. Thank you, Ramon, schooling me there. As one of the greatest achievements, which has been able to get us to have food security worldwide.
Just to remove our what you call it, waste products from our water supply has probably been the greatest one. So the toilet is probably the greatest invention ever created. But nevertheless, excellent conversation. Jonathan, thank you for organizing.
No worries.
Hopefully he doesn't get a grenade into his house.
Well,
in Sweden,
if you listen to
it's
listen
far
to
more
Donald.
Dangerous than Hillbrow at the moment, if you don't know. There was 5 firecrackers last year.
Yeah, there does seem to be a bit of a narrative being pushed for with regards to Sweden. Anyway, enough on that. We will obviously catch you next time. Please, if you like the show, you can rate us on iTunes. You want to chat about anything that was on the show, you can find myself at Jonathan_Witt or at Roman Kabanak on Twitter. Our Facebook page is Renegade Report, and our Twitter, Renegade_Report. Please chat to our guest as well if you want to ask him anything. It's always nice to have some engagement. And we have a Facebook group in which we have quite good discussions. And we'd love to see you there, so you can just find us quite easily and ask to join the group. We'll let you in. Thanks so much for listening to the show, and we will catch you next time. Central.com.